Thank you very much. Great to be here today. And hopefully, again, take note of questions. Hopefully this can be interactive once we get through these prepared remarks. So again, what I want to talk to you about today is the importance of emerging markets to global investing. And I want to kind of make two key points here. Firstly, just the overall relevance of emerging market economies and their impact on the world, and that in and of itself, the importance in the global investing process. But then try and get a bit more tangible in understanding when we really get down to portfolio construction and the way we do it at T. Rowe, why it's just so critical to have emerging market companies in the opportunity set that you're looking at when you're trying to have a truly integrated, high conviction global portfolio. So the first starting point here is our belief at T. Rowe that emerging markets are meaningfully underrepresented in most investment indexes. And that's often what we are held to by clients when they're looking at our bets or exposures, holding us to some limit above some index. So many investors still use the MSCI World, which actually has no emerging markets in it at all, which is actually pretty astounding to me at this point in the world that is still quite a commonly used benchmark. But here on the left on this first chart, I'm going to use the MSCI All Country World as a starting point, which is MSCI's broadest global index. And you see here, emerging markets today have risen to roughly 12% of that MSCI ACWI bench. You know, it was probably 2.5 years ago, and little by little, as those markets have outperformed and fresh listings, were up to about 12. So a lot of our clients will use that as the starting point, 12% exposure. But what we'd like to point out firstly is if we just take share of GDP, so let's forget about markets and publicly traded companies and look at global economic activity, and these emerging market economies today are roughly 30% of the world. Somewhere between 25 and 30, it depends how you measure it and quality of data, but suffice it to say, meaningfully higher than that 12%. And that gap there, just to remind people why they're so underrepresented, in many of these economies, a lot of companies are still government-owned. You know, take Australia 30 years ago, Commonwealth Bank, Qantas, meaningful companies that are big parts of cap today that were government-owned and therefore not in that market capitalization numbers. So that's going to change over time as more and more of these assets get listed and as those economies grow. But then for a growth-biased investor looking for share gainers in good businesses, even more relevant than this 30, if we look at GDP growth today in the world, and emerging markets are driving about 50% of the absolute increase in GDP growth is coming from these economies. And so, again, just back to that first one. Again, we've used the broadest benchmark here. This is the 12. You know, many investors are still zero. And so we'll get people say to us, wow, you got 30% in emerging markets. That seems like a lot. That's, 18% more than this benchmark. That 30% is just in line with this. And there are times, for a growth-biased investor, you could argue you'd want to be even a little bit higher. So I think it's clearly a more important part of the investing landscape than many people realize. The one pushback some people could have, is if they're so expensive and just out of the ordinary on valuations, maybe they shouldn't be given as much due as that growth would suggest. But in the final column there, there's two things. First one is, do the companies in these markets actually have earnings growth in line with that GDP? Okay, you can have a market that's growing real fast, but companies that's so competitive, you're not getting profit growth. But you see here, the earnings growth for these economies, for the companies in these economies, is very robust. That is transferring through to profits. And the valuations at the end, taken as a whole, emerging markets are at the very bottom of global valuations still. They were a little bit higher a year ago. We've had China come back, India come back, et cetera. But, very reasonable, low double-digit multiples for companies in these very robust economies. That's the first kind of mega backdrop of why EMs are clearly important. If we just touch on performance, it has been a hot asset class for the past couple of years. Although I think it's important here on the left to put that in context of this asset class was decimated in the late 90s when we had the Asian crisis, when Latin America had a lot of inflation as well in the late 90s. And so it's been a big relative run from the bottom. But net-net, when you look over the past 12 years, EMs have outperformed the overall developed world market. and it's been massive outperformance for the past few years, but it's not as crazy as it looks when taken in that longer-term context. And then on the right-hand side, if we just take year in, year out, about two-thirds of the years for the last 12 or 13 years, EMs have outperformed. So, again, just worth looking at. Obviously, historical performance is no predictor of the future. So let's step back for a minute, and you know, this may seem a little basic, but I think it's important to touch on, you know, what is driving some of this favorable EM growth. And very simplistically, GDP growth in an economy comes down to labor force growth and productivity growth. And on the left-hand side here, those green bars are the working age population in emerging markets. And, you know, as of today, we're sitting right here in the middle, 2008. And the blue ones are the developed world labor forces. So the first tailwind that these economies have is obviously just more and more people able to join the workforce. And that in and of itself mathematically, you know, helps the growth. And Japan, on the blue ones, Japan's at the leading edge of the developed world where we really have a flat to shrinking labor force. And so you read all these bearish reports about the Japanese economy and why it's not growing. Well, just mathematically, if you have fewer people working and you have productivity already pretty high because it's a very advanced economy, they have a lot of capex, they're already quite efficient, it's just tough mathematically for that economy to grow. I think sometimes that gets lost in it all. Everyone thinks, well, all economies should grow if we just try hard enough. I mean, if you don't have more people working and you're already productive, that's a big headwind, and yet EMs, we have a lot more people to work and productivity is very low. You know, you still have a lot of people not having a lot of capex for their labor and therefore being able to be more efficient. On the right-hand side, too, more than just GDP growth, if we look at the aging of the populations here, this one shows the percentage of people, you know, under 15 and over 65. And again, the developed world also has this big burden of aging populations that they have to deal with on the fiscal side of things, deal with the healthcare of aging populations. The EMs have a lot less of that as well. So that just helps the overall ability of governments to step up and invest in their economies when they don't have to look after this aging society that the West does. So some people say to me, well, this has been true for a long time. EMs have had faster growing populations and, you know, hasn't this always been true? Well, while those backdrops have, here when you look at real GDP growth from 1980 through to 2010, it's only really at the start of this decade, around 2000, that we saw a meaningful separation of real GDP growth in EMs versus the developed world. And you know, not uncoincidentally or whatever, that coincides with the US had had a phenomenal 20-year run, really good productivity growth, good economic expansion, and that helped that developed world side keep up. At the same time that many EMs were still, there were some hitting road bumps while others were going. You know, since 2000, you know, the US has obviously slowed a bit and the EM growth has become more broad. So you see, it is different this decade than it was prior decades in terms of how those demographic factors have flowed through to real GDP. The other criticism of EMs often is, well, they're export-led economies. You know, they're not really diverse, true end markets. And on the right-hand side there, you know, while that is somewhat true, it's changing. The far right-hand bar there shows a number of large EMs, it's by no means every emerging market, looking at the domestic consumption. And so taken as a whole, some of those key emerging markets together now are more than 60% of US end market consumption. So this is a big end market in and of itself now, not just the export story. I mean, exports are clearly still critical, but it's more than that. It's more diverse. The other part, not just as an end market itself, this one here looks at exports of EMs to each other. So this is intra-EM trade. This is India, China, India, etc. And that's becoming a bigger and bigger part. So their domestic end markets are bigger. The trade between each other is bigger. And on the right-hand side, we see the exports to the US as a share of GDP. And I'm not trying to argue here, you know, that we've had, you know, total separation of these markets. I mean, China depends a lot on the US, but it depends, you know, EMs as a whole depend a lot less than they did once. And you know, if you take some of these, you know, if you look at a Russia or a Brazil or an India, you know, people are surprised that we're talking about less than 5% of GDP that those exports are to the US. So the economies are plenty more diverse than that. But as investors, we don't own these economies. We own companies in economies. And again, how does that flow through? That's our opportunity set. So on the left-hand side here, we look at earnings growth of companies in emerging markets versus companies in the developed world. And again, any one year, things can ebb and flow. But taken as a whole, those blue bars there, which are the global emerging markets, have been about 50% higher on average than the developed world. So for all the emerging market outperformance, when you look at the actual multiples in these markets, the reason they haven't expanded like crazy is that it's following earnings growth. You know, we're big believers at T. Rowe that over time, stock prices reflect the growth of earnings of the underlying asset. You know, you can get changes where valuation is extreme at one point or another, but all else equal, if you own an asset where that earnings growth is healthy, and in the EMs, they have been 50% healthier than the developed world over a sustained period there. More surprisingly, on the right-hand side, and particularly topical right now with a global financial crisis and liquidity crunch, is the state of the balance sheets. And that on average, global emerging market companies are half as levered as developed world companies. So at a time where credit access is tighter, credit is more expensive, you know, the companies in these regions have about half the leverage. And so they sit at a pretty good place there too. And that's also one thing when you look at what's happened with broad emerging market crises in the past, where you had credit crunches, the likes of Brazil had a lot of, you know, in the 90s, US dollar denominated debt, you have a negative spiral of FX and you just get, you know, caught unwound. Now, not only do the companies have less debt, the economies have less debt, and in the case of someone like Brazil, the debt they have now, they took advantage of all the easy money in 01, 02, 03, you know, 04, 05, 06, whatever, to re-denominate that in Brazilian currency. So now they're not even subject to the ebbs and flows of the US dollar as much. They're paying back in the currency of their own. Also briefly, IPOs. I mean, you know, where the hotbed of IPO activity is often is a good indicator of where investment opportunities are. The blue portion here is emerging markets, ex-emerging Europe, and then this dotted line is the emerging part of Europe, so basically Eastern Europe. And so taken together, emerging markets today are about half global IPO activity. And so again, that's one of the things that's going to see that representation in the indices just steadily march upward from 12 toward 20 toward probably eventually 30 if it's in line with economic activity. And again, still back on the earnings growth and valuation side because it's companies we own. Here we just break down for people. This is total global emerging markets, the three key sub-EM parts, Asia, EMEA, and Latin America, and then compare that to the developed world. And rather than any one number in here, if you take cumulatively all these emerging market growth numbers, you see companies are growing profits in this definitely double digits and even, you know, 15, 20%. On aggregate over that time period. Where the developed world, we're talking, firstly, you know, if we don't take the 09 forecast, which is probably a little rosy in some of these, albeit that a number like 29 reflects financial companies that had written stuff down, just normalizing. But in aggregate, you see the developed world growing earnings at, you know, mid-single digits, upper single digits maybe, versus 15, 20% in EMs. Again, that should drive stock opportunities and outperformance. All else equal, when valuations are the same, and on the right-hand side, you see they're not that different. Okay, so that's my big picture argument for why having emerging markets as part of the opportunity set is very important. And now let's briefly just touch on then, much more tangibly, as we look at how we actually construct a portfolio, you know, why it's important and how we think about the names there. So I'm going to take a couple of different sectors here. First, we're going to take a sector that's out of favor right now, financials. And the way we construct our portfolio at T. Rowe is very much taking each sector, looking at it globally, and saying where are the most attractive subsectors within that in terms of, you know, what areas have secular tailwinds, what areas have good industry structures, have protected moats around their subsector businesses, and then look for the very best companies globally within that. And so within financials, this has actually been our biggest source of alpha for the last 18 months, 2 years, which was recognizing that the fundamentals of emerging market financials are just totally different to the developed world. If we kind of rewind to early 07, developed world financials had slowing loan growth, They had inverted yield curves, which is going to be a real hit to your net interest margin. And they had credit quality, which was as good as it had basically ever been. Very de minimis charge-offs. They're all provisioning very little on their balance sheets for credit. And what we didn't know then, which was just lucky for us, given we didn't own many of them, was that we also had a whole bunch of stuff they hadn't disclosed to us about quite how big their exposures were to CDOs and RMBS and CMBS and all these acronyms of basically structured instruments that together the industry had packaged together to make what was average credit appear like it was really good credit and therefore get high prices. That wasn't even disclosed. That wasn't in company disclosures, so we couldn't know. But contrast that to emerging market banks. Loan growth 15, 20, 30%, upward sloping yield curves, and credit quality normal. Not really good, not really bad, just normal. So they're provisioning normally. And so it didn't take a rocket scientist in some ways, as long as you're looking across the globe in that structure, to say, if I want the best financial exposure in the world, probably makes a lot more sense to play here with these vanilla EM banks trading at pretty similar multiples than to take these global ones. And so we basically had no developed world commercial banks, nothing in the US, nothing in continental Europe. We did have some capital markets names, some Goldmans and Merrills and stuff, and just owned a host of emerging market banks. Owned one in Brazil, owned one in Mexico, owned one in Russia, owned one in the Middle East, owned one in China, India, et cetera. And again, in that truly global integrated construct, that was just critically important to have that EM opportunity set as something we could pick from. And, you know, really changes the investment performance as a result. So that was a tough sector. So now let's take a sector that's been really hot, energy. And so, again, there's been plenty of good energy stocks in the developed world, right? It's been a good place to be. But again, taking a longer-term perspective on energy, again, we're looking for share gainers, growing businesses over the long term. What's really important in energy to grow over the long term is to have access to new reserves so that you can grow your production base over time. And the issue in the developed world is while there's a bunch of energy stocks that have been really good because the price of oil's gone up, the price of coal's gone up, et cetera, a lot of them are really challenged on their access to incremental reserves and on their access to, or on their ability to grow production. And so while those stocks are really good here and now, you get caught in the issue that so much of it is driven by price. If that price goes the other way, how much conviction do you have as a manager to really want to hold that asset believing it can still grow? And so, you know, the importance of this spare production or ability to grow production and have access to scarce resources, including the emerging markets in that opportunity set, again, changes everything. So back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, Exxon, Shell, BP, they would go into these emerging markets, they would offer to, you know, bring in their capital, help extract the oil, and in return, they'd pay a bit of a royalty, but they'd make a handsome profit. 85% of the world's incremental oil reserves now lie in emerging markets, and these countries just aren't willing to give access to Exxon or BP or Shell, or at least not on reasonable terms. You know, they want an 80% royalty now, not a 30% royalty. And once oil's above 100, they'll take 95% royalty, etc. It changes the whole game for them. So again, looking globally at the entire global opportunity set, you know, we can own a Gazprom in Russia. Again, hasn't been great over the last couple of weeks with what they're doing there in Georgia, but it has the world's biggest gas reserves. It's trading at 4.5 times earnings, and you're co-invested with the Russian government. You know, there's no oligarch there to put off in Siberia and take those assets back. It is the government's asset. Or in Brazil, we can own Petrobras, which is sitting on top of the biggest modern world oil find in the Tupi field. So again, just having those companies there, even in a hot sector where there were plenty of stocks that worked in energy in the developed world, having the EM, it gives us names. Even when things are working, we feel better. We're going to be able to hold for a longer period of time, even when the price of oil tanks. So something like, you know, Petrobras, as it comes off, as oil sells off, you know, we can buy more of that one. Whereas if you're sitting on an Exxon or a BP or a Shell or something like that, it depends a lot on your view of the price. This is just an interesting factoid. You know, people always ask, where do you think oil's going from here? And our view is that in the short term, it probably heads back under 100 as some political uncertainties pass. But that over the long term, oil is headed onward and upward. There's a bigger demand for it than supply of it. And what this one just shows is if we take China and India here, this is per capita consumption of oil. We've got China and India at the bottom, less developed. We've got South Korea and Japan as economies that have middling energy use. You know, they're very urbanized populations. You don't have a lot of cars. You have a lot of public transport, etc. Then you have the US, obviously, at the top with big cars, people living a long way out in the suburbs, etc. But let's assume, let's just take China here and take the third of China which lives near the coast. So we're only going to take the more developed part of China. And let's assume that those people, their energy consumption over the coming years just goes even halfway to South Korea and Japan. So we're even going to take the middle of the road energy economies and just take a third of people halfway to there. That would require the world to add an entire another Saudi Arabia in terms of the output of oil. And there just isn't a whole nother Saudi Arabia out there to be added. And the other issue for oil that's underappreciated is even the Saudis now have come out in the last 6 months saying, you know, our big fields are declining. One of the issues in oil, all else equal, an average oil field declines at 3, 4, 5, 6% as it gets on. So you don't have that flat production out of a given thing, and a lot of the world's bigger fields are declining. So you need a whole nother Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabias in existence are declining, and you've got this EM demand coming on. So we're pretty bullish on oil in the long run. Last one I just touch on again is telecoms. This is an area we're pretty bullish on. It's one of our favorite ways to play emerging markets. And again, it's illustrative of the just total difference in fundamentals when one's looking at a global sector, sometimes between different economies. So in the developed world, telecoms is a very competitive business, particularly wireless telecom, which is really the sub thing I'm talking about here. You all have a cell phone. Some of you probably have two. You've got a BlackBerry and a cell phone. You know, you want more minutes, and you want them at a cheaper price. And that's the only way you stay with a carrier or switch to another one. So it's not a great business for the carriers. You know, they've got to spend more and more money because you're taking more data down on that, and they're getting less money from you. So if you're just looking in a developed, if you're a world investor, XEM, that whole industry is quite challenged. But then if we take emerging markets, and so that's this, you know, penetration of wireless in a lot of the developed world is up 80, 90, 100, even above 100% where people have two SIM cards, etc. You take less developed markets, you see India at the bottom there. I think the data is actually a little off here. Maybe their penetration is 15 or 20%. But in India right now, 6 million people a month are signing up for a cell phone. Now that's the entire population of Australia in a little bit over a quarter is fresh cell phone subscribers. And you've got a whole lot more of that to come. That could play out for, you know, 5 more years. And so not surprisingly, the leverage in a business model when you're getting that many new people signing up is it's just a whole different ball game to playing with telecoms in the developed world. China Mobile, another factoid people are surprised at. You know, it's not 50 million wealthy people in China who have a cell phone. China Mobile has more than 510 million cell phone subscribers. 500 million people for one company, you know, SIM cards out there. They're not all, you know, people there swap SIM cards to try and arbitrage prices, etc. But again, just illustrative of having those emerging market companies in your opportunity set and taking the best of a global sector can just really enhance the ability to invest. So with that, that's the prepared remarks. Let's open it up for questions and...
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah, so let me separate the two parts of that question. Let's address the second part first. So, you know, emerging markets, clearly many of them have greater political risk than developed markets. You know, whether it's China, they'll just change the rules on an industry. As much as China Mobile has 510 million cell phone subscribers, earlier this year, China decided, you know what, this is a bit too concentrated. We've got one company with 500 million people there. They're making a lot of money on that. So you know what? We're going to reorganize. We are going to top down tell this whole industry to reorganize. So there's like three players. We're going to make you two pair up. We're going to take this license away from you, China Mobile. You know, just changes the rules. So we don't invest in China Mobile as a result because that's an economy where the regulation around telecoms could have moved. It is moving. And again, in Russia, there's risks. So what we try and do when there are risks, as in the case of Russia, the two names we own in Russia today are Gazprom and Sberbank. And they are as close as you can be to co-investing with the government. Again, Russia is right on the far side of political risk in the GEM world. And so it's most relevant there. So where if you're invested, in an average Russian oil company, and you've probably got good access to reserves, you've got good growth, you're feeling good about it, but then the oligarch falls out of favor with the government, you know, the assets are stripped, he's off to Siberia, and you know, as a foreign investor, you're just, you know, you're kaput. Well, in the case of Gazprom, the government's co-invested there. In a very perverse way, you can actually benefit when they strip someone else's assets because they throw some of them into Gazprom at a cheap price. That's not the thesis there. But again, if anything, there's less risk and even potentially some upside. And so where you have big political risk, we try and be very wary of not being out there in areas you can just be stripped. And in extreme political risk, if you take a Zimbabwe, if you take a Venezuela, we just wouldn't even touch them. You know, we won't even go there. There's no price at which some of those where you just have no confidence in owning the asset is there. The other thing in EMs generally on that risk side that I think is really important to mention is we're really big believers in how much skin in the game does management have. You know, there's a huge difference. We own a Roscom Telecom back on the telco example. It's a Middle East African telecom company based in Egypt. And this is three Egyptian brothers, very wealthy, kind of Kerry Packers of Egypt, three of them together. They own different assets there. And that's the entire family wealth in these three assets, one of them being this telecom one. And so there you're co-investing with a very smart local who has all their money on the line. And then you compare that to a China Mobile where you've got someone who was maybe a bureaucrat now running a big telecom company. You know, maybe he's got a few shares from stock options in there or whatever, but it's not their money. It's not that same ownership. And so that's the other big risk mitigator. You make sure you're with locals who've got their own money in the game, very different from just a random manager sitting over an asset. So that's on the risk side. In terms of the biggest issues we see in GEMs right now, it's really inflation. So emerging markets clearly have a better growth outlook, but they've also got higher inflation. Inflation in the world is an issue, and it's even more of an issue in emerging markets. So in Russia and the Middle East today, inflation is probably running 15%+, very high. In Asia, you're probably talking 10% if you take China, India, those together, and then Latin America is more like 5-6. So actually, when we look, so firstly, we take a diversified set of EMs to offset some of that risk. And again, we're owning companies, not economies. We're really bottom-up focused here. But Latin America, when you add it all up, is our biggest overweight for this very reason, that they've come out of a decade of fighting inflation. They had hyperinflation in the early 90s. They've had 10 years of central banks having high rates to make sure positive real rates to get inflation down. And so their inflation, while China and India is accelerating and struggling with it, their inflation, they're upset that it's 6 versus their target of 4, or 4.5 versus their target of 3. It's the one region of GEMs that has positive real interest rates. You know, China and India have interest rates of, 7, 8, 9, 10%, but their inflation is there. So that's, roughly zero real rate. And then in Russia and Middle East is the worst. They're pegged to the US dollar. So we've got US style interest rates of a couple of percent with inflation of 15. Right, so you've got massive negative real interest rates, fuels the whole boom. And so it changes the opportunity. So inflation is the biggest thing we're watching out there, and it does impact it. Doesn't mean we invest nothing in Russia or the Middle East. Again, those economies are massively benefiting from the oil boom. And when you have inflation like that, real estate can be a good asset. You know, oil has to flow through the financial economy, et cetera. So, but it impacts it. What else? Yeah. Sure. Okay. So again, we're bottoms-up investors. We're looking for names where we can make 20% annualized return going into an investment. So we're normally trying to play for 40, 50% plus over 2 years. And so I think simplistically, we see a lot of high return opportunities there. Some of them probably do have higher risks. Some of them maybe not so much. So I think there is also some diversification benefit just in general portfolio construction, like any diversified portfolio. But it's probably more that we see, high return potential there. But again, this is very bottoms up. We don't say Brazil, would be a great diversifier if we had a bit in there. So let's just, you know, go find a few things to put it in. We see that Petrobras is the world's best big oil company right now, and you know, it has the best production growth, and it's trading at 9x earnings, and you know, et cetera. That's how it gets in. But I think that answers the question. On the currency side, in emerging markets, our team analyzes currency country by country as part of the investment thesis. So if we don't like the Turkish lira, you know, Turkey's one country right now with a huge current account deficit in a world very reliant, they're still very reliant on foreign capital, and there's not as much foreign capital to go around or liquidity in general. And so you get a risk that currency goes down, then that will impact us not even investing in Turkey at all normally. So at the EM level, it's very country specific and gets wrapped into the stock. You know, compare that with China or the Middle East. You know, Middle East has a peg. If the peg stays, you get the US dollar return. If the peg goes, you probably get some nice appreciation. So that's factored into the fact that, you know, that's a positive on those stocks. Or China, you know, over time, they can't fight this currency moving up some. And then we separate that, though, on the big currencies. If we take the US dollar, the euro, the yen, then we think about those much more big picture portfolio risk. Do we have massive underweight or overweight to the US, the euro, the yen, and do we have a strong view on that? Frankly, I think currencies are so hard to predict where they're going, and even the people who do it for a living get it wrong a lot of the time. So it's not like we'll see that we're massively underweight the yen and say, oh, we'd better close that gap. We say, you know, do we have a strong view one way or the other, and that may tweak again the bottom-up selection on there, but we're aware of where our risks are. What else? Yeah.
Just if you could touch a bit more on, I guess, the earnings risk side. I mean, we always talk about, obviously, the demand obviously growing internally in these emerging economies.
Yeah.
Can you touch a bit more on what the impact of a global recession would be from two aspects? One, obviously, on the earnings of these companies, something that has probably supported their growth over the last 5 years.
Yep.
And on another side, internally, I guess, there are profits being maintained. We talk about this inflation rising and the inflation wage spiral that
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, there's, you know, there is, you know, no sector or country right now that, you know, I feel is, you know, bulletproof on this stuff, right? Every investment has risks. Every economy has risks. And particularly in these EMs, they have had very, very robust earnings growth. If we go back, okay, so if we go back here, you know, we've had EMs that have been growing 30% and the world's saying, okay, maybe they grow 15% going forward. So clearly, you know, the first thing is they are slowing, okay? There is no doubt China's growth is slowing. It was 12, has been running 10. Maybe it's going to be 7, maybe it's going to be 8, maybe it's going to be 9, maybe it's going to be 10. We don't know, but it's less. But you can view that as half full or half empty, right? It's slowing, but it's still 7, 8, 9, 10, real GDP growth for the world's third biggest economy, right? So take your pick. And at different times, you know, investors lean on different sides of that. Sometimes it's slowing, get me out. Sometimes it's, well, this is still 3x as high as the developed world, you know, sign me up. So it is slowing. Margins have expanded a lot and probably won't expand as much. And so clearly in people's estimates, they're not assuming they're going to grow at the same rates, right? So this is now 15, and maybe this should be 10, not 15, right? But with the positive things going on there, we still think there's a lot of companies that are going to have expanding markets, chance to still post meaningful earnings growth. And again, just remember, so much of investing is about valuation, not fundamentals. That's one thing if they were slowing from 30 to 10 or 15 and they were trading at 20x earnings, that, you know, that would be much more concerning. But when they're slowing from 30 to 10 or 15 and we're already at 10x earnings, that's a whole different, you know, whole different fish. The other one is, again, it varies by region, right? So Asia, particularly China. China is a very export-led country. And so the world slowing is clearly having an impact on China, and that's the big unknown right now. How much is it? Now, that said, they can still go do a lot themselves in upping infrastructure spending and filling that gap for a while, which we'll see if they step on that gas or not. Contrast that with India, which, you know, for anyone who's been to India, you just see, right, they just have a whole lot of work to do themselves before any export stuff. I mean, they have this IT thing. That's only 1 million people in India out of 1 billion, you know, who are really involved in this IT outsourcing. Otherwise, you need to build roads and power plants and airports. And so there's a lot of internal growth that can happen there just aside from the rest of the world. their issues funding. So it varies across then, you know, no easy answers overall, but still factoring all that in, we think it's important to have it in your universe, and we're finding plenty of good ideas in that universe today.
One more question?
Yeah.
Question on sort of corporate governance, the governance.
Yeah,
rules.
Great question.
I imagine in some of these countries, they're a little slack, a little hairy.
Yeah.
I believe in one near neighbour that the legal system is such that if somebody owes you money, you can go to court and get a judgment, but there's no way to enforce that.
Yep.
How do you handle those sorts of
things? Yeah, no, great question. The two-part answer that I'd say, firstly, it's not always as good as it seems in the developed world, firstly. Let's take US financials. You know, we have all these great rules in the US of disclosure. We had Sarbanes-Oxley where everyone had to sign on the dotted line that, you know, I'm personally liable if there's issues. And lo and behold, you know, a year ago at the peak of all these issues, these companies weren't even disclosing that they had all this stuff there, right? So, you know, while there are issues in the emerging world, let's not kid ourselves that at the end of the day that, you know, there are issues there. But they clearly are worse in the emerging world, no question, less disclosure. And so this really comes back to the point I made in one of the earlier comments, co-investing with managements. Really the only way, for us, that we feel better that, you know, how do you control what you don't know and what you're never going to know? You make sure the person who does know it has all their money on the line as well. And that's where having a manager who was a bureaucrat or doesn't have skin in the game, you know, it's very easy to, oh, we restate results. Oh, sorry, we're changing that. But if they've got, you know, 60% of, you know, their net wealth or more in it, and, you know, that's what they're focused on, they're probably less likely to, you know, do some of those things or at least try and minimize the damage. And so we're very, and that's one of the things we love. You know, some of our biggest single country overweight today is India. And it's a couple of things. One, we think, again, India controls its own destiny in some ways with what it has to do there. But a big part of it is that India has this great group of entrepreneurs who own their own businesses, who actually are so frustrated that they only own 30% of their business and they had to give 10% up to get it listed, you know. They're not looking to cash more out. They're like, damn, I had to give 10% up. I wish I had 40, not 30. You know, they want more skin in the game. We're in the West so often, it's just this constant stream of owners or CEOs cashing out options saying, I need to be diversified, you know, I want to be diversified. I want to make sure I got my 100 million on the side if, you know, when Countrywide goes under, you know, he's still sitting there with his money. It's very different in India. And so that's one of the things that gives us comfort, even though there's a lot of unknowns with India, uncertainties. Very wealthy people, very connected, very savvy, their money's on the line, let's go in with them. So it's a little bit quasi-private equity approach just about even in a public market. So that's key. Okay, that's Q&A.
Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Just ignore the mic.
I guess in the context of the theme of the conference, you know, putting the pieces back together, I think when we look at global equities and where we stand now and the questions that you need to be asking your clients or clients are asking of you, where do you go for future global growth? For us, we don't want to be constrained by a benchmark and certainly our opportunity set when we're looking for investment opportunities. And for us, that liberty to go down into emerging markets, but as well as frontier markets, the Middle East and Africa, is certainly something we want to have open to us at all times. And I'll just get Scott to touch on how we go about capturing these themes into our portfolio in terms of how we construct our global equity strategy at T. Rowe Price.
Okay, I'm going to make this real brief, just one slide, like 1 or 2 minutes here, just to give you a sense. We often get asked, you're trying to invest in the whole world. You're trying to invest in small, mid, large cap companies, developed world, emerging markets. That's a big, big sandpit. Just how procedurally or, you know, what's the process by which you can do it. And so for us, we feel very blessed to have really three bites at the apple, or three lenses through which to view the world before Rob and I add our own overlay of ideas. First one is, T. Rowe has analysts, like many investment firms. We've got 110 to 120 spread around the world, Baltimore, London, Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, Buenos Aires, people on the ground, know the managements, have the models on the companies, watching the valuations, industry specialists, you know, industrials analyst in Japan, healthcare analyst in Europe, et cetera. And so like any firm, these analysts have their ratings, and so we can see what do they like, what don't they like. But also we have analyst-run money. In the US, our analysts run a pool of $20 billion. So if you're the industrials guy in the US, Peter Bates, you call in trades on $1 billion for your 5% of the S&P. And so Peter may be recommending 10 or 15 names at any point in time, but he may own half of those in the analyst-run money, and we can see his relative bets. And so our first screen, just to see where is people's convictions, where should we do our work, is what are the analysts own, you know, what are they recommending? So that's the first thing. But there's 115, 120 of them to look at, so that's a lot to keep up with. Then we have global sector strategies. So these are funded mandates in every key global sector, you know, from financials, healthcare, tech, real estate, resources. These are run by folks who've been in with us typically 10 plus years, sector experts, and this really comes into the fore, somewhere like healthcare that Darren mentioned. You know, truth and disclosure, when I'm sitting down trying to analyze Gilead or Genentech, and you're looking at these biotech companies, and they're talking about this biologic agent's in this stage of development, it could have a chance of addressing Alzheimer's, it could be this. I mean, how do you handicap that? How do you even know if you know, they're talking, you know, talking from where they shouldn't? And that's where having someone who is a John Hopkins trained doctor, who knows what's going on, who can call people and talk in a way that I just don't even know the kind of questions to ask, what things to look at. So I've got four doctors on our team there, and I can be looking at not just what do our 8 or 9 healthcare analysts recommend, but what does Chris Jenner there own in the Health Sciences Fund? And so looking at his position sizes, you know, can also help me see which analysts there probably should I be looking at more than not, or which subsectors of healthcare. Same in resources, big, long cycles. You know, maybe some of our analysts have only been with us 3, 4, 5, 6 years. All they've seen is a bull cycle in materials. Charlie Ober, who runs that strategy, he's been with us 25 years. So he's seen when, you know, the iron ore companies were just squeezed and squeezed and squeezed and were never going to make a dime, and, you know, now they can put prices up 50% a year. So he can keep that in perspective versus just having lived through one. And then finally, we're blessed with regional strategies. So T. Rowe, again, is a global investment firm, full complement of every region. We have US, small, mid, large, growth value core. We have European, Japanese. We have emerging markets. And in emerging markets, not just do we have an EM fund, we have a LATAM fund, we have a New Asia fund, a Middle East Africa fund, an emerging Europe fund. So again, these people, domain experts, 10 years, you know, Francis Dadasco managing New Asia, been going to India 4 times a year for 11 years. So when we're investing in these Indian companies and we're trying to say who has their skin in the game, who knows it, we're not just reading that in a report. Francis has, you know, been visiting these people for 10 years. So that becomes particularly important in EM to give us the conviction to do it, to have domain experts who really know that stuff. And so then we cherry pick basically best analyst ideas, best sector manager ideas, best regional manager ideas. Then Rob and I do our own work. We go see the managements, look in the whites of their eyes. We read the reports. We try and look at the valuations as much as you can. Get out in the field, and we end up with 75 names. So that's it. That's all from me. There's some of the names we own.
Thank you, Scott.
No problem.
Don't move, everyone, because we've got 2 or 3 things to do before we go. But first of all, I think you'll all agree that you can quite see why Scott is top of his class. Not only is he full of knowledge and information, but he's also a great presenter. So look, on behalf of us, Scott, thanks very much.
No problem.
And to T. Rowe Price, thank you. In a minute, I'm going to invite John Wong of Van Eyck to give us a kind of 1-minute summary of what we've just had. But before we do that, I'd like to just get you to get your gizmos out, put your card in the slot, and in a moment, I'd like to take a vote on this session so that we can put it into the voting that will take place in a moment. So, everyone ready to vote? Okay.